And what it has to do with is the question of condensates in optical lattices, and in particular the excitations of these condensates. The work that we did had to do with the long wavelength excitations, which is no great surprise, are phonons. And so the work that I will partly refer to is published already in this paper with Ed Taylor. And we looked at a very narrow question as to do with the long wave excitations in a optical lattice. And the question had to do with how you go from the uniform gas in which the speed of sound is the square root of gn over m, which is related to the mass of the particles and the compressibility of the gas. What happens when you have an optical lattice, a periodic optical lattice? It could be a one-dimensional optical lattice or a three-dimensional optical lattice, it doesn't matter. What happens to this formula? You still have a speed of sound that was confirmed by numerical work that Berg Sorensen and Milmer did. Just solving the 1D GP equation directly, you find that at long wavelengths you got phonon excitations. Javanainen did that using a tight binding model, and you get a different expression. And basically, what we were interested in was, you know, what are the parameters that govern the speed of sound? Can one sort of get a general expression in terms of some calculable quantities? In particular, you'd expect that GN gets replaced by the compressibility of the gas in the optical lattice, and then the M gets replaced by some effective mass. Now, there was some work done by Kramer et al., and that's the group of the Trento group, where they did sort of a long wavelength approximation to the optical, to the excitations, and they didn't really specify what they introduced an effective mass M star, but it wasn't very well defined. And so that was part of the reason why we got into this, was trying to nail down exactly what that effective mass was going to be. The other thing that we're interested in, and we really haven't done that much, once you get into this whole problem of excitations in optical lattices, it raises other questions related to just sort of what kind of band structure you have for these states in these lattices, what sort of excitations you have, and then one encounters various instabilities in these systems that are directly related to some of the things that have been observed experimentally. And so what I want to do first is just sort of talk a little bit about what has been observed experimentally. And there have been a number of experiments. Most, I think all of the ones that are really interesting or relevant to me here are from the Florence group, and there's in particular this one here in which they first observed this onset of dissipation in the flow of the superfluid, and we're trying to understand what the cause of that onset of dissipation was. And then there were other papers that are very much related to that. This paper was again by them, where they basically increased the depth of the optical lattice in which you're getting into the sort of tight binding regime, and then they found that they could sort of explain account for their results by the theory of Smerci et al., which used a sort of a discretized version, tight binding version of the atoms in an optical lattice. I'll mention this one as well shortly, and this is the most recent work that sort of it relates to relates to, you know, what the onset of this instability is, was what it's due to. All right, I guess I don't have to look at that. Is that focused pretty well?
It's fine.
It's okay? Yes. Well, let me come back to this first experiment, sort of set the stage as to what is done there. And what they are dealing with was an elongated, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this experiment. Maybe some of you are. Maybe some of you are not. It's a kind of a nice experiment. What they did is they take an elongated trap gas, magnetic trap, and then they apply along the long axis an optical potential. Okay, so this picture here is basically what the for the strength of the optical potential, what the condensate looks like. Okay, there's lots of wiggles on the scale of the optical lattice, but the optical lattice isn't too deep, so the density never goes to zero anywhere.
So what's that area supposed to represent?
This is a blown up region of this here. You see the condensate just oscillates because of the underlying optical potential, right? But it never goes to zero. So you're not in the tight binding regime, right? It's a density profile of the condensate. Yeah, that's right. As simple as that. And so the red here represents the magnetic potential. And basically what they do is instantaneously displace the magnetic potential relative to the optical lattice. Okay? And so the condensate then finds itself on the side of this magnetic potential. And then, of course, it'll be accelerated towards the minimum. And then it will then oscillate back and forth about the new equilibrium position. All right? And so what they did was to measure this this oscillation. And so they can do that as a function of the amount by which this condensate is displaced. Okay? So delta x is then related to the amplitude of the oscillation. And down below here, what you see is the position, the center of mass position of the condensate as a function of time for two different cases. The black line here, let's see now, the triangles, I guess, are the, what did it say here, pure magnetic trap, okay? And that just gives you the frequency of the the confinement potential. And then with the optical potential, the oscillations persist. They're undamped, all right? So you have a coherent motion of the condensate. The period is somewhat longer, and that simply is related to an effective mass, all right? A larger effective mass, and so it goes slower, all right? In the paper of Kramer, it all shows how that comes about by introducing this effective mass, yeah?
Yeah, maybe you can give us a summary. Do you believe this Gross-Fidelsky can explain all of this, or no?
Well, that's part of the question, and to a large extent, when it's dealing with low-temperature condensates, in the regime where the Gross-Fidelsky equation should be valid. So everything, in principle, to some extent, should be describable by GP. All right, that's sort of what.
So that's the bottom line. Yeah.
There's a lot of issues that come in. That I'll sort of mention. Okay, so this is what you find if you have a displacement delta x which is not too big, and then they looked at what happens as a function of the magnitude of that displacement, and they found something rather interesting. I'm not going to be explaining this. I'll be referring to this. Our work didn't really explain this. There's other papers that have sort of looked at this problem. Here, what they're looking at is the amplitude of the first peak after the initial peak. So if relative to the amplitude of the displacement, all right? So in other words, if there's no damping, this stays at one, right? It's the second peak amplitude relative to the first. So it's a measure of the decay of the oscillation. So and as a function of this displacement, and what they found was that over some range of displacements delta x, the amplitude doesn't change. You have an undamped oscillation of this center of mass. And there's a very sharp onset here, and then the amplitude decays rather rapidly as you move it beyond that point. Okay? So what that's showing is, and the interpretation is that the larger you displace the condensate up the side of the potential, it accelerates down, it comes with a higher velocity, reaches a higher velocity, all right, and at the minimum. And then the idea was that, well, if it reaches a certain critical velocity, you will have dissipation setting in. Yes?
They did a controlled experiment in which they did this without the optical lattice.
Without the optical lattice, all you do is have an oscillating condensate.
I mean, that's not totally obvious, but yeah, they did actually see that.
They did to the extent this here is for that for the dotted line is for the
yeah right I mean this is what I was asking about is logic.
It's less than a millimeter, so certainly it's within the homogeneity.
Are you you're worrying about the fact that you would not get, this would break down even with the magnetic potential? No. There is a solution of the time-dependent GP, non-linear time-dependent GP equation, which corresponds to just simple rigid body motion.
Like sometimes nature doesn't like theorists.
Oh, that's true. but the GP equation does have this solution, and for any amplitude, right? Okay. Whether experimentally you would see something happening, I don't know.
One question in the chat was probably a little bit anharmonic out towards the edges, right? So.
But anyway, this is what they see.
I thought the interpretation was opposite to what you said. Why don't you go to the second page?
No, I haven't said anything about the interpretation yet.
No, I thought the observation, not the interpretation. I thought what they observed is when they made the offset larger than a certain amount.
Yeah.
The gas doesn't come down anymore.
Yeah, no, I'll come to that. No. What happens in this regime here is that the gas does oscillate, but there's a damping of the oscillation. But it's more complicated than that because what they see is indicated down here in this figure here is sort of a spread in the gas. All right? Once they're into this regime, if they're in this regime up here, the size of the condensate is more or less the same, right? But as they get into this dissipated regime, the gas spreads out along the axis of the trap, and what they were interpreting that as is that there's one component which is the condensate, and then another component which is some the excitations from the condensate.
What is this gas profile? This after the gas profile after.
Yeah. So once they have accelerated and they're in this regime here, okay, where the thing is being is showing dissipation, they image the cloud, and the cloud has this kind of profile. Okay.
In the middle.
Okay. Well, no, it just happens. Well, somewhere it just happens to be someplace in the trap, right? And then they release it, and then they image it. And so the idea is that there is sort of a condensate, which is still oscillating, but then there's a whole bunch of stuff back here, which is related to this dissipation, all right? Which you might interpret as, well, thermal excitations, all right? However, it's not so clear, and that's the other thing, is that how do you interpret this? Because it turns out that this kind of picture comes out of the GP solution itself, all right? And the most recent calculations done by Modugno, DeFalvo is one of them as well. They're the first ones to do a full 3D simulation corresponding to the experimental geometry, full D simulation of the GP equation. And in fact, they get profiles that look very much like this. Okay? Just coming from the solution of the GP equation, right?
So this is for very small, this doesn't have to be for very large, I think, say around 80, something like that.
And even these people did simulations, right? They did 1D simulations.
Which paper is this from?
Which one? Well, this is all from the Berger et al. Paper.
That's the original book.
That's the original Berger et al. Paper, yeah.
Why are the two curves in the
top? Two curves here?
Yeah.
Well, one curve is just showing you the undamped oscillation, the other one's showing you the damped oscillation.
No, I mean on the non-linear.
Here? On this? The two different points?
Yeah.
Okay, the triangles there are a GP simulation, a 1D GP simulation. And it shows this. And what happens in the 1D GP simulation, at least it's not clear. They argue that it isn't consistent in this paper, right? That's what they say. They say. Well, that's just their estimate of the condensate part of this distribution, all right? So they sort of try to extract what the condensate part and what's left over. I don't know how good a job they do, because then they have a theory that describes how much condensate is left as a function of this velocity. This velocity here is would be the maximum velocity that the condensate would have when it goes through the minimum. Okay, and so by by extracting this condensate part, if they can do that, they can plot that as a function of the maximum velocity, and they see that it falls off. And then they interpret everything in terms of Landau instability, Landau criterion, which I think is all wrong.
Also, this figure is not direct. It's an interpretation of some theoretical result.
The points are their result, their experimental extraction of this bump.
How do they extract NS from experimentally?
I don't know. They take this picture, and they somehow fit one component, this A component, and this B component. And the area under this A component is what they attribute to the condensate that's still there, right? And everything else is something else they don't really explain. But and then the area under this A component is what they plot as a function of velocity. And then they get this curve, which is theory, their theory, which is based on the idea Landau, the Landau criterion, that is that the speed exceeds the local sound speed. The speed of the condensate exceeds its local sound speed. And the sound speed goes as the density. So the tail of the distribution is where you violate the criterion first. And so the Landau instability, according to them, occurs at the tail. And they so therefore calculate how much of the tail is going to be unstable according to this Landau criterion, right? That you get that from the GP, from the Thomas Fermi solution, and that's what that curve is. And so they said that everything works perfectly good, right? And that.
And you think it's totally wrong?
I'm not the one that thinks it's totally wrong. Other people have come to the conclusion that that idea is totally wrong.
Why
isn't it? I'll come to that eventually, I guess. All right. So, and then here is what these two guys did. Yeah.
What determines this direction of this tail?
Okay.
Why
that's an interesting question. That's an interesting question. And I think that's related to another experiment that they did that I'll mention in a second. Okay? So if you just hold off, I'll mention that other experiment. Because I think it's related. Although nobody's really said that. Now here is supposedly a simulation of the sort that they mention in this paper. This is done by two other people. This is Wu and Yu in a comment. And this comment was criticizing their interpretation in terms of the Landau criterion because they had said they had looked at this problem of phonons in an optical lattice and were the first, I think, to identify the existence of a dynamical instability. And they're attributing this dynamical instability to this dissipation to a dynamical instability. So they did a simulation. What they show here is this k basically represents the velocity, I guess, of the condensate as it's passing through the minimum. Okay, so what they do is they displace the trap, let it oscillate, and here's a situation where this dissipation doesn't take place. There is some modulation, but nonetheless, the condensate basically oscillates coherently back and forth. Okay, and then when it reaches a certain value of this velocity, this maximum velocity, they see this rather unstable evolution of the condensate in their GP simulation. Okay, and so they attribute that and they to this dynamical instability, which I'll try to explain as I go along. Okay,
and they said this is different from the Landau.
Oh yeah, it's definitely different from the Landau instability, and we can understand that difference very very easily by looking at the excitation spectrum. Okay, yeah.
In what part of the experiment they explain as dynamical instability? Is it the n sub s or the a one over a? What do they explain with this?
No, they basically trying to explain what the origin of that onset is. When you have this dissipation setting in at some point,
I see.
What is that due to?
And there,
yeah, what is it due to? Okay, and their interpretation is that there is a dynamical instability. And in the what is the dynamical instability? If you consider, say, let's not worry about the trap. You consider a uniform optical lattice and calculate the bulk loop of excitations. Well, this is quite general. It doesn't really pertain to optical lattices, but if you just take the bulk loop of equations and you find a complex eigenvalue, that's what you mean by dynamic instability, right? Because you have an excitation which is complex, that means that the excitation grows in time. So what the idea is that if you're in this region where you have these complex eigenvalues, then a small perturbation would excite this excitation, then it would grow in time. As it grows in time, that's a linear stability analysis, of course. As it grows in time, you leave the linear stability regime, but nonetheless, it leads to this very strongly structured solution. That's the full GP, nonlinear GP equation, right? It leads to that kind of structure, okay? So, the dynamical instability is related to a complex Bogoliubov eigenvalue. The Landau instability has nothing to do with a complex Bogoliubov eigenvalue. My understanding of it is that it has to do with a negative Bogoliubov eigenvalue. And so I'll sort of say something about that later. so now, what, yeah, the previous picture showed that this distribution has this tail. And that's, I haven't got a picture of it, but this latest paper by Modugno et al., where they did the 3D simulation, show that structure exactly. What they show a sequence of figures where they're trying to simulate the experiment, and they have, as a function of time, it starts off with a nice condensate. It's accelerating, it still maintains the structure, and then at some point, what they find in this 3D simulation, that this tail, okay, it's not that the tail breaks up. They see that the onset of the instability occurs at the center of the condensate, all right? But then as it evolves, what they find is that they get this sort of garbagey tail at the back. This part is coherent, and this part is very, very turbulent in their simulation, all right? And this turbulent region stays behind.
The whole thing is moving, right?
Yeah, it's... So the potential, so what we're doing is looking at, say here's the minimum of the potential. We're looking like this, okay? And here the thing's accelerating. It's got to a point where it's reached this instability, all right? And the onset of the instability is what they attributed to, and they study this in terms, they explain it in terms of the dynamical instability as well, that there is a dynamical instability that sets in at the center of the condensate. So you generate these very unstable modes, and then they grow in amplitude, but this continues to evolve, the condensate continues to move, and it leaves this tail of turbulent gas. All right? Now the question is, why is it left behind?
You mean the instability fully evolves, fully develops during the time smaller than just one period of oscillation?
Yeah. And that depends on how high you are up on this potential. Because the higher you are up, the faster you get to a higher speed at an earlier time, right? So, and then when you get a critical speed, that's when you get this instability.
Also, the extraction of NS is actually reasonable, except, so the question of what is the interpretation of the first, or the onset of the first?
That was the whole question. And then there was a couple of comments between Wu and Yu and them, that Wu and Yu maintained its dynamical stability, they maintained its Landau stability. They did another paper where they had a deeper potential, and then they said, yes, it agrees with Smertzes et al.'s dynamical instability interpretation. However, our old results are still Landau criterion. And then they redid the most recent experiments they redid. I'll mention that too. They say, well, it's all just dynamical instability.
Okay,
because they wrote that paper in conjunction with Modugno and Del Falvo and so on. So the picture seems to be clearly is related to dynamical instability rather to the Landau instability. That seems to be the picture. And that seems to be consistent with the data. Now what's happening here, I'll come back in just a second. There's another interesting experiment where they did, this is all at very low temperatures where there is no thermal cloud. They also did some experiments where they had a thermal cloud, okay? And that's interesting, and I think that's what Lee was referring to. Because if you have a thermal cloud by itself in the optical lattice, if you're above TC, you just have a thermal cloud, you displace it, what they find is the thermal cloud doesn't move. It stays, okay? And then what they did was an experiment where they have somewhere a 50-50 mixture of a condensate and a thermal cloud, okay? Then they displace it, okay? So here you start off with a condensate and a thermal cloud at the minimum of the potential. They displace this over to here. The condensate oscillates out,
wow.
Right? and it goes up to this side here, where it starts off on this point and it ends up on this point. And then, but the thermal cloud doesn't move, it just stays there. All right? And then what they did was they just shifted this potential back to here. And so then you have basically the situation where you have the initial condition is a thermal cloud here and a condensate here displaced. And then this condensate oscillates through the thermal cloud. And they did two experiments, one in which they shut off, after this preparation phase, they shut off the optical potential. So you just have the magnetic harmonic trap. And what they found then is that the motion of the condensate through the thermal cloud accelerates the thermal cloud, and eventually the two oscillate together, as you have to have for harmonic potential. All right? And then they did another experiment where they kept the optical potential on, and throughout, what they found was that in that situation, the center of mass for the thermal cloud basically stayed fixed, and the condensate, which was displaced, would just decay exponentially, like this, okay? Because what's happening is that it's transferring the collective energy to the thermal cloud. The thermal cloud is being heated up a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much all the experiments. So this picture that this result that the thermal cloud sits there, I'm not quite sure why that is happening, but it does sit there. All right? It's consistent with this garbage at the end, if you think of that as a thermal component, being stuck behind, and the condensate continues to oscillate. Yeah.
Well, from the parameters of their potential, they should have been as overestimated by the diffusion spread of the thermal cloud. Did they actually do that and check that it was low enough that the experiments were consistent with that interpretation?
The diffusion spread of the thermal cloud?
Yeah, I mean, basically, they just modeled this as a set of Josephson junctions. Well, I mean, Josephson junctions have a normal conductivity as well as a Josephson current. They should have been able to calculate.
No, there's no mention of that, so I can't say one way or the other. Huh?
It has to be possible given the exact knowledge of the
potential. Uh huh. You're referring to the fact you're trying to explain why it is that the thermal component doesn't move.
Yeah, one wants to make quite sure that the predicted, calculated diffusivity of the
Are you sort of thinking that the thermal cloud is just a classical gas, or not?
I'm taking their model, which is basically a set of Josephson junctions between.
Well, it's not in this experiment. You really shouldn't be thinking that because you're not in that tight binding regime. There's another paper that's true where they go into that tight binding regime, but this original paper was not in that regime. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think they're in the different regime. I mean, I think they're in this. That paper is.
Well, in any case, I mean, the point is really dependent.
That's the same. The science paper is the same as this one here. As far as the parameters are concerned, this New Journal of Physics paper, and that is really in the tight binding regime. So
I think there's a big difference. And one, so in the tight, if you really get the tight binding regime, you have to think about the possibility of having fragmented plums. Right? You have to think about the modeling of the possibility, all the dynamics that could go with that in the system. Whereas if you're in the GPE regime, you have a small potential. Then you have two possibilities, and one possibility is that you have this swell at Tailson, which leads to these dynamical instabilities in the band structure, and the other possibility is that potential is high enough so that you're not in the Mach regime, but you don't have any of these unusual features in the band structure. So I really see actually in fact three different areas. Two of them can be modeled by Grosz-Podiebski, and the other one is totally out of Grosz-Podiebski. Now when this thermal tail, the comment I wanted to make earlier, Gene, is that when the thermal tail comes out, if it is really low amplitude, maybe that thermal part is somehow entering into the tight binding regime, if you like, in the sense that it really has a low, very low density compared to the potential height. And then you can't model the tail, even though the running the Grosz-Podiebski equation will get you the projection out of the coherent state out of the out of a Hubbard model, but it still won't get you the real dynamics of what's going on in that tail. And how can you know about the details of turbulence anyway? So I mean, I see it as a
the point I'm making, which I think is a rather generic one, is that if I'm far enough out of the molecular regime, then I should be able to do a rather simple calculation in which I calculate not just the, if you like, the Josephson-like, Josephson-like flow of the condensate, but also the diffusive flow of the normal. I think we have enough parameters to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one thing that might check is whether when you get this apparent localization, it is simply very poor. It's basically you have a sort of mobile system, that's basically a metallic system, but it's very, it's just very, very bad. Diffusion is very poor. Or whether you really do have something more like an instrument.
Right.
Well, I don't know if this is related to that, but the theory of Smerci et al. Is based on a tight binding approximation.
Yeah.
And they attribute the onset of dissipation, they sort of compare their tight binding model to a GP simulation, and the two agree. And the onset of the instability, according to them, is again this dynamical instability. And their simulation shows, okay, as opposed to this one, well, something similar happens, but there they find that the condensate just sort of disappears, just becomes a thermal component, which just sits there, all right, and that's consistent with the experiment that the motion then becomes overdamped.
But is it tight binding? Is it the discrete NLS or is it? It's the discrete NLS.
Yeah, they did both that and the GP solution.
No, but I'm saying
continuous.
There's another regime, which is the Mach regime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chris Pethick is in here because he had some really good comments on this to me in a private discussion. And in those comments, he said that you can actually see the transition towards Mach insulator as you go towards the discrete NLS. Even in the classical theory, you start to see that the relative phase between wells is unimportant somehow. So you're losing the phase coherence between wells.
Yeah.
So I think
well, the discrete NLS is showing that too, right?
Right.
That at some point, beyond a certain point, you get randomized phases between the
So what they're saying is
from
that
one well to the next.
You really should be using something like a Hubbard model because you have the possibility of entanglement.
Yeah. Possibly. I mean, that may be. That maybe there's other aspects here that require analysis beyond the simple GP equation that people have been using so far. I don't know about that. Yeah.
I thought even with a pure condensate, with the lattice on, if you move the offset to larger values, the condensate wouldn't move either. The condensate wouldn't just get stuck.
No, I don't think I've ever seen that particular result.
Because Smerci's paper was starting with Pierski, so that only applies to condensate.
Yes.
It doesn't apply to concept. That's part of the point of this
discussion. Well, no, the DNLS is really just a discrete version of GP. It is just the GP equation.
You can define at least the classical field that is orthogonal to the condensate within the condensate of Grosz-Podievsky. There's some nice work by Keith Burnett on this and also by Ivan Kostenko. So to that extent, you really can model something that is not exactly the condensate. It has to be small. But you can get
that
some kind of classical version of
the Gulliver. What you are saying is that the Psi-4 equation, which people call Grosz-Podievsky, is the equation for the amplitude of the boson.
Yeah.
If you have modes with large occupation numbers, you don't care whether you have a condensate or not, you get this equation for the amplitude. And this was long before Kildor had
this.
Right.
Just
in the case of a discrete system, basically you can have a lot of particles on one side, 100, 1,000. Even in this case, your classical field description in terms of amplitude can become unapplicable due to the effect of quantization of the number of particles. So it's actually a more subtle question. You need to compare the energy associated with moving one particle, basically it's a Coulomb blockade, with the amplitude. And if they become comparable, then the effects of quantizations are important.
Let's Eugene continue on with the phenomenology and his talk, and then since we have about 15 minutes or so.
I don't care really how it goes. I mean,
I think we are very interested in hearing the. We can discuss later after we hear all the facts, and then there's a question of what part of this phenomenology can be explained by GT or not GT, but then we have to hear the phenomenology
yeah.
and some explanation first.
Perhaps if I can just make clear this distinction between the Landau criterion and the dynamic instability, that might be enough to sort of. Wrap up the discussion, and I don't know. I mean, you can always read my paper if you want to find out what I exactly did. But I told you what I did. I just sort of figured out how to, in the case of optical lattice, what these parameters should be, and then also generalize it to the case where the condensate has a macroscopic flow. So, where you have you write. The solution of the GP equation as this plane wave factor times a function which is periodic in the lattice. All right, that's an excited state of the GP equation corresponding to macroscopic flow, superfluid flow. And then, so what are the excitations? Long wavelength excitations for this situation, okay? And then we cranked that all out and got an answer for that. And turned out that after we did that long calculation, Pethick and company had a one-page little heuristic derivation of the result, which agreed with what we had obtained. So there is an easy way of getting that result and a hard way. And the easy way is sort of thinking in terms of a local energy functional, where you think in terms of the local density, which is a function of position, and the local wave vector, which is a function of position. And these are obtained for uniform systems, right? And then you can think about how these variables in long wavelength, you don't have to worry about the discreteness of the lattice. And you can use that energy functional to derive equations of motion for the fluctuations of these two averaged quantities, all right? And what we did, though, was took the Bogliubov equations, and then looked for long wavelength Bogliubov excitations. And we just took Q equals zero, bang, and worked everything out with, you know, by brute force, and you come up with this picture at the end. All right, so that's the bottom line as far as the excitations at long wavelengths is concerned. You can sort of think in terms of this local energy functional, in terms of a local density and a local macroscopic superfluid wave vector, okay? Okay. So, I think Lincoln sort of brought up swallowtails. They're not really necessarily related to what was going on here, but they're sort of interesting, and I found this quite fascinating that because of the nonlinearity of the GP equation, you find very funny behavior. You can find funny behavior at the zone boundaries or at zone centers. And there's a long paper by Macomb et al., Macomb, Pethick, and Smith, which analyzes these swallowtail instabilities. That's the chemical potential as a function of the wave vector. And this is from their paper. They show you this is now the energy per particle as a function of the wave vector. And then this very funny structure that they see at the zone boundaries of the zone center is related to, and they analyze it in quite a bit of detail, related to this nonlinearities in the GP equation. Okay, that's not necessarily related, though, to anything I'm talking about. That's a sort of a side issue.
I thought that if you ran off the... So if you increase quasi-minimum until you run off the edge of that swallowtail there, I thought that that's where some instability was. It was really important for these
No. In this paper, the experiments were done in the regime where there are no swallowtails. Swallowtails come in when the interaction strength is relative to is certainly larger than the potential well depth. Okay? So there's some criterion. So the criterion is that the ratio of G n bar over V0 is sufficiently large, and you get these swallowtails. The experiments were done in the opposite regime, where these swallowtails don't appear.
Even the latest experiment?
I think so. I haven't checked the numbers, but I think they're in the regime. So the swallowtails aren't related to the instabilities that have been seen. And in these in this paper, of course, you can look at the dynamic instabilities of various states. And they looked at the dynamic instabilities of the these branches on the swallowtails. And this, my understanding from reading their paper is that swallowtails are related to soliton-like states that you can have even in the absence of an optical potential. There are such states for uniform gas, right?
But there is this also a new experiment by Esslinger where he was accelerating this wave packet in optical lattices, and then he realized when he close to the edge where these swallowtail structures show up, then suddenly the gas delocalizes and fills completely the first brilliant zone. Do you know that?
Maybe. I'm not sure if I've seen. I don't remember the name.
That
but
was by Esslinger, the ETH.
Yeah. No, I can't. Doesn't come to mind. But I don't think I can't remember it. So there's a lot of issues related to what happens when you're into this regime of these swallowtails and what consequences they might have on the dynamics of the system. But so just to perhaps finish off a little bit, I just want to emphasize this distinction between dynamic and energetic instabilities. Energetic in this field is synonymous with the Landau criterion, okay? And I'll sort of try to explain why that is. I mean, maybe everybody knows that. I didn't know that. So I'll sort of explain it. Basically, the energetic instability has to do with, and this is a situation where you have, say, a superfluid flow, okay? Or vortex or something like that. But you start with some stationary solution of the some stationary point of the GP functional, and then you expand about that point, and the structure of that energy change is given by the fluctuation in the change in the condensate wave function times this operator, and this operator in fact is the same operator that appears in the Bubble-Buff equations, right? But here we're just looking at the energy, okay? And this operator is Hermitian, all right? So we can look at, for its eigenvalues, it has real eigenvalues. And if the eigenvalues are all positive, then that is a local minimum of the functional, all right? And that's what one means by energetic stability. However, if one of these eigenvalues turns out to be negative, then one has energetic instability, okay? And so that means that one can go to a different stationary state, which will have a lower energy. So this structure of this operator is the same as appears in the Bogoliubov equations. I have it. Maybe I'll write it out. I have something written out just to perhaps help you see this.
So that means you shouldn't have complex eigenvalues.
Well, that has nothing to do with complex eigenvalues. You can't have complex eigenvalues of this guy here because it's Hermitian, right? So where did I put that? I have a transparency that I wrote out that shows now the connection between that and the Bogoliubov. I'll put it over here because the wind is blowing things around. Okay. So here, just this thing again. Okay, there's the energetic instability. Oh, sorry. All right, so there is the energetic change in energy of the GP functional. And I just summarize again. So if you find a zero eigenvalue, that signals an energetic instability. And you get a negative eigenvalue, then you have a different ground state. Now, the structure for the Bogoliubov equations is essentially the same. I mean, they have the same matrix. I've written it in a way so that it looks exactly the same. This matrix times UV is equal to E times, there's the sigma Z, right? That flips the sign of the up and down components. And so throwing this on the other side, you have this equation. Now, if you find that there is an energetic instability, that means you find an eigenvalue which is lambda equals 0, that eigenvector is also a solution of this equation with E equal to 0. So you have an excitation that has 0 energy. All right. So when you have an energetic instability, meaning that you have a negative eigenvalue of this matrix, that would correspond, I think, I may be wrong, but I think that corresponds to the Bogoliubov excitation becoming negative. Okay?
Well, you can't tell. You don't really go off in the complex plane, can you, by this one?
Hmm?
How do you know it doesn't become a measure?
Because this one does not have a measure.
But how do you know that it's Hermitian?
Well, oh, it's not Hermitian. I mean, this operator sigma z times a is not Hermitian, right? So these eigenvalues can be complex. All I'm saying that by continuity, you'd expect that when this eigenvalue is 0, you'd have a 0 eigenvalue here. It could happen that as soon as you go beyond that, it becomes complex. But it could also mean that it becomes negative.
But why in the case of Landau instability, you show that your operator is Hermitian?
Well, the A operator is Hermitian. This operator is Hermitian.
But you mean
when you expect, it's always Hermitian.
It is Hermitian.
It's always Hermitian.
Yeah, the energy operator is Hermitian.
Okay, but suppose that we.
I mean, I raise this because not everybody's thought about these things. I thought these are interesting points.
Let me be quite careful, actually, because instead of actually pushing our velocity through the Landau critical velocity, we instead change the sign of the interaction from positive to negative.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think everyone agrees that you get a dynamical instability, a complex eigenvalue.
Right.
And, you know, you just carry out
right. Yeah. But what we're doing here is thinking in terms of pushing the wave vector, the velocity of the condensate
it's a
through a particular critical value, right? And at a particular critical value, you develop this negative eigenvalue of this matrix, and that corresponds precisely to, for the uniform gas, precisely to the Landau criterion that the velocity is greater than the speed of sound.
Yeah.
All right, so that is why this energetic instability is identified with the Landau criterion, because they give the same result for the uniform gas.
Okay, I'm asking a simple question. If you were to actually solve the Gross-Pedersky, the time-dependent Gross-Pedersky equation around a value of, say, circulating current in a uniform system, circulating current which violated the Landau instability,
mm-hmm.
would you find a negative eigenvalue or a complex one?
You mean like in a ring geometry?
Sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You think it'd be complex?
Yeah.
So do I. I mean, that's my guess. So I don't see why there's a difference here.
No, I don't see why. Why would you say it's complex?
Oh, just because you get that complex.
Well, I don't know. I haven't done that calculation. I would think it's the usual Landau criterion. You just get a negative eigenvalue.
Yeah. If you linearize it.
Okay, let's be let me
in this case,
if you solve the whole dynamical problem completely.
Okay, let me just put this up. It says dynamic instability, but let's not worry about that for the time being. I just want to sort of use that to illustrate the correct Landau criterion, okay, first of all, in the context of the Bogoliubov excitations. So the red here basically represents the Bogoliubov spectrum for zero supercurrent, okay? Okay, we have a symmetrical branch. Of course, these are the positive eigenvalues. They're also negative eigenvalues, which we usually just throw away. Right? They're, we refer to them as spurious. These eigenvalues, these ones have norm u squared minus v squared equal to 1. The other eigenvalues have u squared minus v squared equal to minus 1. So we throw those away. But anyway, they do come out, right? They do come out of the Bogoliubov equations. Now you then increase, put in a flow, a supercurrent. What that does is that tilts the spectrum, right? And so if you start off with this sort of symmetrical situation, then one side goes up and one side goes down. So the spectrum, and then if you add in the single particle part, it goes like that, okay? And this is related to the velocity of the of the flow, which is related to the k, h bar k divided by m. This is the uniform case, right? So, and this slope has slope s, this slope has s plus v, this one here has s minus v. So at some point, if you make v large enough, this branch goes negative, all right? And that's what I mean by going to having this negative, this energetic instability, all right? Well, what is your question is that you get a complex eigenvalue, but you don't. You get this real eigenvalue.
In this particular problem.
Right. You can see just now it's Landau's original argument.
Right.
Which is fine. Mm-hmm. My technical question is, suppose that I actually solve the Gross-Podolsky equation, I linearize the small oscillations around a uniform current carrying state which violates the Landau which is lost. What then? Do I find a negative eigenvalue or complex eigenvalue? No.
I think you get a negative eigenvalue.
Okay, that's a different problem.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't get complex, always real.
Okay. I'm not sure at all, because now it's a non-linear problem. We have a finite velocity.
No, he's talking about the linearized problem, though.
Well, linearizing it around.
But not about the zero velocity state. We have a finite supercurrent. Everything can be absolutely non-linear. I mean, it's not at all obvious that when linearizing about this new state, you will always get just positive and negative rather than complex.
But all I'm trying to do here is point out, right, that this energetic instability is synonymous with the Landau criterion. That's how one thinks about it. Okay? So, well, I mean, this is the example that I'm using to make that connection. When analogy, this example is familiar to everybody from the uniform gas case. And so the more general situation where you have this energetic instability is then interpreted as the Landau criterion. Okay? But it's not the dynamic instability. Because even though you have this energetic instability for the uniform gas, you do not have a dynamic instability for the uniform gas. The dynamic instability only arises when you have a lattice potential. That's what makes it interesting. An optical lattice. You need an optical lattice to get this dynamic instability. Okay? You can never get a complex eigenvalue for the uniform.
I guess there will be a meaningful difference if the physics leading to the Landau criterion is different from the physics that lead to this dynamical instability. Now, I have not done calculation. I don't know whether in the optical lattice, the Landau criterion merely corresponds to comparing the energy of a state with the one with that is
Well, that's the calculation of Wu and Yu. They did that.
And I was also wondering, maybe you can answer the question. Now, the question, what is the essence of the dynamical instability? Now you have this barrier. Now, the physics presumably is that somehow the phase winding is between different wells get accelerated for some reasons. And now it's the question whether that physics in this dynamical instability is the same as the physics for this Landau criterion in the optical lattice.
No, they are distinct, and I'm trying to explain that to you.
It's not a calculation question whether there's a difference in physical processes. Yeah.
So, okay, let me do the following. K is the K here is the wave vector for the superfluid flow. Okay, so it's the e to the ikx.
What is the Q?
And the Q is the Bogoliubov excitation wave vector, all right? So when you have an optical lattice, you can look for solutions of the form U of X, E to the, there's an overall factor, E to the IKX. This KX comes from this thing, and then you have E to the IQX plus V star E to the minus IQX. That's the form of the Bogoliubov excitation for an optical lattice, okay, for a periodic system. And so you can look for solutions of this type for any Q in the first Brillouin zone, right? K here is restricted to the first Brillouin zone as well, all right? So K represents, this is sort of increasing the superfluid flow, All right, supercurrent. And this is looking at what excitation you're interested in. And so there is a particular k, right, at q equals zero where this eigenvalue becomes negative, right? But if you're somewhere sitting over here, this eigenvalue here is positive, right? Right? I have to increase k further to get to that point, to get that point at that q negative. So the general structure is that if I go from 0 to pi over d, 0 to pi over d, that this branch sort of looks like this, turns out to go to pi over 2d here, close to that, it does that. So that's sort of the line at which you have this Landau instability. This is the energetic instability, okay? So this, for the weak potential, this would be the usual Landau criterion, okay? All right. So that's the Landau instability. And if you go to the right of this, then you have these negative eigenvalues. And experiments have been to the right of this and nothing happens. So it seems to be that it has nothing to do with the Landau.
So say that thing again?
You can be in this region here and nothing, there's no instability experimentally seen. All right? Because there's another curve.
But you say that the eigenvalue acts in that region.
No. I this is the Landau instability. So E becomes negative here in this region. All right? That's how I'm interpreting the Landau instability. But then you have to ask, well, when do these excitations have a complex eigenvalue?
Yes.
All right? Well, they turn out to have a complex eigenvalue first at the zone boundary. For a q equal to pi over, this is all due to Wu and Yu. It's not my work. And then this branch depends on the parameters, the potential height and the density of the gas and the interaction strength. But then this branch typically goes like this. And so this is the dynamic instability. All right?
Because you're violating, as it were, pushing current beyond the critical current of the individual resistor junctions.
I don't know. I think that would be over here. That's just the. I'm not. Maybe it is. I don't know. I don't know how to interpret that. But this is the point. This line here marks the line at which you start getting complex eigenvalues.
Before you get your imaginary or complex eigenvalue, just by continuing, don't you have just to reach a zero value and only then complex?
Yep.
But once you reach zero value, it's exactly correspond to Landau. A violation of Landau criteria because your critical velocity or what you just said, so just prior to getting your dynamical instability, you just violate Landau criteria.
Well, it's true. No, that's the thing. You don't have to go to zero.
But how?
No. You can have a real
complex without just.
No, you can have a real solution. You can have a positive real part, and then all of a sudden it branches off.
All of a sudden it branches.
Yeah. So you don't have to go to zero.
I see. Okay.
All right. And this is what happens, typically. At some point, you get this complex eigenvalue. You have to have a pair without
going to zero.
That's right.
That's definitely not Landau.
No. And that's the kind of thing that happens. All right. So and then the latest paper, experimental and theoretical paper, makes it quite clear that this is the critical. This is the relevant instability for the blowing up, dissipation that's setting in, right? So it's becoming clearer and clearer that that's the case.
That's because the formal emission is too small.
Well, you know,
this is
not clear. What happens when you get into this regime? Do you emit phonons or not? Can you emit phonons or not?
According to this picture,
it looks like you should be able to excite these phonons because they have a lower energy. Where's that energy?
But the emission, the temperature, terminal emission can be very low.
It's the matter of kinetics.
Yeah.
they call this instability statistical because it implies just that you need some kinetic time and so on and so on.
In the sonic, sonic black hole context, is the only graduation that temperature determines the graduation. Temperature is usually critical.
I was told by high authority maybe you should wrap up. But before I finish, I think maybe I should let Eugene to say a few words to wrap things up. I think
Well, this last little bit here, I don't know, it basically tries to explain how it is when you turn on a lattice potential, you can generate a dynamic instability. And basically what's happening there is that you, turns out that these spurious modes that you usually throw away, you have to keep. Because there's a degeneracy between these modes, which you can refer to as phonon modes, and these modes, which you can refer to as antiphonon modes. And for example, you can see here, I've indicated this antiphonon mode here is degenerate with this one. And the lattice potential couples these two. So you can set up a perturbation theory. This is what we did in our paper, set up a perturbation theory to show that the coupling of these two, this what you think of as this physical and unphysical mode, right? Coupling between these two modes gives rise to a complex eigenvalue. And you can calculate what the complex eigenvalue is, and it when you do that, that picture agrees with the numerical results of Wu and Yu in the weak potential limit, right? This is the argument in the weak potential limit. So there is a simple way to understand how it is that the optical potential gives rise to this instability by a coupling of these antiphonon to the phonon branches, all right? And so these antiphonon modes aren't always spurious. In fact, when you want to calculate the phonon modes, the Bogliubo excitations for an optical lattice, they in a sort of perturbative way, they do become important.
Only in the case when you get your complex eigenvalue.
Well, that's to explain why you get a complex eigenvalue.
Yeah, but in the case when they are real, there will be no coupling between spurious and non-spurious modes.
Yeah, but all this okay. Yes, true.
But let's
yeah, that's true.
And I'd like to thank Eugene particularly. I think this is really an example. That is a good example of really a good discussion. He has performed a great service for all of us, and he talked a little about it, is what he gave us a general view of things. No, I would like to thank you personally very much as an organizer. I think thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope you appreciate it, but I mean, I didn't touch on very much of my own, but
This is very good. It's very helpful. Thank you so much.